John and Maddie McIndoe had that experience this year where they could choose, and I'm sure you chose earlier, maybe a year or two ago, but to go anywhere that they wanted to for their 40th, and they picked a very intriguing place, and that was Antarctica. John and Maddie McIndoe, welcome to the Roadhouse. It's nice to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, John and Maddie have been as long-time, part-time people here in Cook County, as you have had a place on Devil's Track for, what, over 20 years?
Yep.
Something like that?
20 years this year.
Okay. Yeah. And I believe you had, your mother had it before, somebody had, no? I guess my memory's not good. It seemed to me Lindsay said her grandmother had a place there as well.
Oh, she used to visit primarily to see Lindsay, but also
okay.
to see us.
Yeah. Okay, I got it. Getting back to Antarctica, now it was your 40th anniversary. Whose idea was it to go to a cold, frigid place on your 40th?
Well, I can tell you it was not John's.
Okay.
I must admit, I went down there a non-believer and came back a very much a believer, and okay. I want to thank Maddie for making that happen.
Mm-hmm. And Maddie, maybe you can explain where the idea came from and how you were able to convince John to go there.
Well, I don't really know how the idea came to me. I've always uh-huh. just been intrigued by the place
yeah.
and by the pictures. My grandfather actually was on a whaler in the Southern Ocean.
Really?
So there was some sort of that history of the sea. And
uh-huh.
Anyway, I like ice and snow. So.
Yeah. And John, you decided against maybe your preferences. You were going to tag along.
I was. I thought, well, you know, she's not been right or wrong.
There better get
I'm
that
in
one
trouble
right.
Now, yeah.
Yeah.
Usually, when these things pop up, she ends up having been right. So I said, "We'll uh-huh. give it this. We're going to go with her this time." And by golly, it was interesting talking to our friends and acquaintances before we went, or even after we came back, and they sort of fall into two camps. You know, one camp said, "Wow, what a great trip! Gee, I wish I could do that." And that's the minority. The majority of the people that we run into is, "Why in the world would you do something like that?"
Really.
And I must say, I was probably more into that camp until I got down there. And as I said, I've changed my mind.
Well, it's always been high on my list, but it's not an easy thing to line up, and it's not an inexpensive thing to line up. It's a long way from anywhere. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the early part of your trip, what it was like to get there.
The trip was sponsored by Lindblad and National Geographic, and they put together something of a package. In this case, it was a two-day pre-trip to Buenos Aires. And so we flew from MSP to Atlanta to Buenos Aires and had 2 days there to get to know the city and the environs thereof. And then we flew down to Ushuaia, which is the most southern town in the world. Ushuaia, Argentina, where we boarded the boat after taking a tour of the Beagle Bay for a dinner cruise, actually. So we had several days prior to boarding the ship, but once we boarded the ship Sunday evening, we were off and headed out, and from that point on, it was almost a constant activity, hour after hour. In fact, sleep was kind of hard to come by, and you didn't really think much about getting it with so much going on.
Now, Ushuaia, I guess you'd describe it to most people, it's like southern Patagonia. If folks are wondering, you know, what part of Argentina are we talking about here?
It is actually very close to where the two countries come together, Chile and Argentina. In fact, you can sit in Ushuaia and look, and there are the Andes. And
really?
The major industry of Ushuaia is to outfit people for trips in Patagonia and into the Andes, or putting them on or outfitting them for boats to go or ships to go to Antarctica.
Now you're on the boat, you're on the ship, and how far is it to travel from there? Is it like a day or day and a half?
From Ushuaia, it's it's about 650 miles.
Okay.
And I think it took us about 33 hours.
That's a ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's across the open Arctic
Ocean.
That's
across the dreaded Drake Passage.
Okay.
Which is what everyone says, you're crazy to go there. Oh. Because it's some of the roughest seas on the planet.
Mm.
So, known to really do a lot of damage to a lot of ships.
Now, how was it for you, though?
It was great. It was flat.
It was flat.
These stars were aligned right.
Yeah, yeah, you're living well.
The disadvantage when there's no wind and the Drake is that you don't get a lot of the seabirds because they rely on the currents, the wind currents. Mm. So we saw some albatrosses and fulmars and petrels, but not nearly as much as if the wind had been higher. But with the wind higher, you'd also have bigger waves.
Now, can you see those birds just in any ocean environment, or are they more birds that you're going to only see in the Arctic, fulmars?
That's a good question. I can't answer that specifically, but there are a limited number of seabirds in the world, and the majority of them are found in the Antarctic. Whether they're seen outside the Antarctic, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Wow, and now you're getting closer to the continent. I imagine you're seeing more and more ice as you move along.
We saw our first iceberg. I think the first about 18 hours out, it was sort of a vagrant iceberg. But as we got closer, we could see all around us, out our porthole, everywhere there was an iceberg to be seen.
And how do you describe those to people who haven't seen an iceberg up close? You know, there you are kind of on a level with them.
Well, I think these were mostly the big tabular icebergs that are really big. Mm-hmm. Because if you're in this immense sea, and if you can see it a couple of miles away, you know it's a big iceberg. They're imposing. And they're stark in this big, wide open sea, and you see this big thing floating in there. It's really quite unique.
Tabular icebergs, for those who don't know, and I didn't before this trip, are actually large chunks of ice that break off glaciers. And they tend to have flat tops, and they're quite large, sometimes miles, square mileage in diameter or in square surface. One of the things that those icebergs that come off glaciers tend to show that we may not see otherwise is this intense blue color above the surface of the water and certainly right under the surface. And that represents ice that has been compressed over thousands of years and is so dense that it reflects the blue light, whereas the white ice on top is what you'd expect to see.
And as I understand it, there's always more ice under the water than there is that you see above it. And I can't remember the amount. It's like three times as much or something like that.
Something like that. I heard various estimates, somewhere between four and three times.
So the boat can't get too close.
Right.
No, although they actually stay quite a way.
Uh-huh.
Not so much for the singular floating bergs, but you certainly don't want to go very close to anything that's attached to the shore, because they're constantly calving and get these little tsunamis and they can implode at any moment. So it's a little scary, but a little fun too.
I've experienced that on Greenland.
Yeah.
Where we were on shore and you got to get into your kayak quick. Of course, I didn't have a ship to hop into, just a kayak. And because the wave just comes up, it's an immense amount of water that gets moved.
Right, you don't even see it from the outside. You can only hear it.
Mm-hmm.
On these, you never saw anything. I've seen glaciers calve in Alaska, and you could actually see them fall. But here, you heard the sound. You didn't see anything fall, and then all of a sudden, you got the wave. So.
And that's a very, very loud crack. I mean, it's hard to describe. Maybe you could, but for me to describe that, it's just like a thunderclap. A big, huge thunderclap.
And you actually look around to see where it came from because you don't see it drop into the ice drop into the water right away. But you do see some spray and some mist that sort of gives away the site of where it happened.
Now, the ship that you're on, could you describe that a little bit for folks?
Yeah, it was it's a converted Norwegian ferry boat that was converted in 2008, if I remember. to become this icebreaker tourist scientific vessel. And there was room for 150 guests and 88 staff. Everything was beautifully appointed, being very well put together. It was certainly not a hardship to be on that boat, but I wouldn't call it a luxury liner either. It was just a very nicely put together and well thought out design. One of the unique things that we took advantage of a great deal was the open bridge. Instead of not being allowed to be up there seeing where it was happening, it was open 24 hours a day, and the captain would take time to sit and talk to us and show us maps and things, tell us things that we never would have picked up otherwise. It was redesigned so that the front end is reinforced to be an icebreaker, and apparently it's one of the more effective icebreakers on the seas today. The back of the ship was widened so that as it went through the ice would be pushed away from the prop so that it wouldn't get caught up. But I can't tell you much more about the technical aspects of the boat. Mm-hmm.
But it's comfortable.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, it's very comfortable. It was
great.
Really,
and
very
comfortable. You're not rolling around daily. Is it calmer seas once you get to the ice? They tend to calm the
very much
seas.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that could be very variable.
I suppose.
We were lucky. We had really nice weather, and it was actually a lot warmer there than it is here.
And nice weather didn't mean like it was 75 degrees and sunny and you were getting a tan.
Well, you were getting a tan.
You were.
Well,
yeah.
Because the sun is very intense
down
there, and it was, you know, almost 24 hours of daylight. So
all that ice reflection.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
it's
the poles, you get a lot more
It's more intense
radiation too. Yeah. But it was only like 20, it was 20 to 30 degrees. I thought it was rather balmy.
Yeah, that's pretty nice.
It was nice.
We're speaking to John and Maddie McIndoe, and they just returned a short time ago from kind of a trip of a lifetime, a cruise down in Antarctica. You also had some other folks aboard, naturalists, who were able to help point a lot of things out?
Yes, I was very much impressed by the staff who were numerous National Geographic naturalists and photographers, or both, who had been part of this expedition activity for a number of years. They would come down for various numbers of seasons, and they were from all over the world, but most of them parts of the United States. And they were on deck essentially 24/7. If you were out there and you were trying to capture just the right light on your film or your camera, not a film, but they would come up and they would give you tips on what to do and how to compose and how to set your f-stops and things, constantly helpful. And then when some wildlife came up alongside the boat, say a humpback whale, we'd get a lecture on the spot about the whale. So we were constantly working with these people or talk. It really was more play than work, but learning almost every minute.
And I imagine we should tell folks that the reason 24/7 is that the sun was out.
Absolutely. We had 2 days or 2 hours of gray each day, somewhere between midnight and 2 a.m., and that was basically what passed for night. Otherwise, the sun was out. Although the sunset, or the so-called golden hour, lasted about 4 hours, so it was a beautiful opportunity for photography.
How did it affect your sleep?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I found it difficult to stop what I was doing, and I didn't get tired. I think eventually it caught up. I had to take an afternoon off once and take a big nap. But that was how I was affected. Maddie, you want to?
I slept really well because I loved sleeping on the ship, but you were also pretty tired because we were off of the ship at least twice a day on land and hiking or kayaking or in zodiacs. And you really, as they said, this trip is too expensive to sleep. So they didn't let you sleep. There was always something to do. And I was just, the staff was so knowledgeable, you know. We got a video every evening of where they underwater dives and you could tell us all about what they saw under the ice, and it's pretty remarkable.
Tell us a little bit about getting out on the ice. Now, you take a Zodiac in and then clamber onto the ice?
All except one day. The standard trip was, because it was a ferry, it was built so that at the water level there was a large opening which could be closed. Oh. And so we would walk out onto a floating dock and either hop into a Zodiac, which would take us to land, or on a tour of the ice, or we were put into two-man kayaks, inflatable kayaks, and given the run of the afternoon. So that was exciting. One day, which was something that we had looked forward to because of all the brochures, the ship actually went into the sea ice, into about a thickness of about 4 feet, and parked there, and then set down the gangplank, and we all walked out directly onto the ice and had a morning of just cavorting around.
You feel a little bit like Shackleton, or?
Well, only the knowledge the boat was going to be able to leave when ready.
Better fed, hopefully.
that was one thing that we got a lot of history lessons, even got to, they talked about Scott's letter that he wrote to his wife as he was dying there, and it's inconceivable to me how those people managed under the conditions and the time that they did, and what they accomplished, because you could tell what a extremely harsh environment it was, and it's just, it's to their credit that they did any of that. It's amazing.
You know, it's funny that we always talk about Shackleton or Scott. We never talk about Amundsen, who was the only one who was successful. He was just too efficient to be fun.
Right, and then Scott's emotional attachment about Scott dying there, being the second one to reach the pole.
The heroic thing.
Yeah, he seemed to have gotten much more press than Amundsen did.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
So,
well, I'm sure you saw a lot of wildlife. Maybe you can tell us what were the highlights of what you're able to see and experience.
Well, of course, the penguins.
Okay.
They're hysterical. They're funny. They live to be kleptomaniacs. They build rock nests. So they're constantly, rocks are at a premium, obviously.
Oh, I suppose.
So they're constantly stealing rocks from one nest to another, and it's hysterical to watch. It's just hysterical. They're funny. They slide. They're amazing acrobats. And anyway, we saw four different species of penguins. So they were just great.
Did you see anything of their enemies, either the orcas or the...
We didn't get to see an orca, but we had several encounters, unusual ones, with the leopard seals. The first was during one of these evening wrap-ups where the underwater camera had been busy all afternoon, and this leopard seal came up and started to chew on the prop of the Zodiac, and then came around the side and started to bite the actual inflatable part of the Zodiac.
You were on board?
No, we were actually watching this video.
Oh, it's a video.
Yeah. And we subsequently found out that these ferocious beasts eat mostly krill, or these shrimp, and they only eat the penguins on occasion. It's not their staple part of their diet. The interesting thing is we also noticed that they adopt ice, and this is what happened at this particular afternoon. They adopt these floating pieces of ice, small icebergs, if you will, and they go around them, and they rub up against them, and they sort of bond with them. And if you come anywhere close to that, they'll come after you, and that's what it was doing this day, trying to attack the Zodiac. Yeah. But the other and perhaps most touching part was that one day we were out doing an ice tour with our Zodiacs and got the call that there was a leopard seal nursing her pup on an ice sheet of ice. And everybody rushed, of course, to see it. And there she was, looking very non-dangerous and very maternal. And I understand that that sort of thing didn't happen that late in the season very often. So the naturalists that were on board were absolutely as taken by it as we were.
Hmm. Now, they're big, as I understand it, aren't mm-hmm. they? By big being 6-7 feet or something?
I would guess, I don't recall exactly hearing a weight or a length, but okay. this thing that we saw, well, in both cases, were quite large. Mm-hmm. Although, I don't think we saw a small seal the whole time we were there. Our first island stop was to see virtually dozens of elephant seal pups. And as pups, they were huge. Their mm-hmm. parents were tons, but these were about 4 months old, getting ready to go out on their own. And they were huge as well. So I guess when I saw the leopard seal, I wasn't particularly impressed that it was larger than the other seals that we had seen, but maybe that's just because of the luck
and
of the draw.
What you've been seeing. Yeah. Well, was there anything, you probably had certain expectations, maybe Maddie more than John, because she had been thinking about it a little longer, of what you would see. Were there some things that you didn't expect to experience that you did? That were highlights for you?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that we saw wildlife and this incredible landscape all the time. I didn't expect it to be quite so full.
The trip itself to
yes.
be so amazing.
I mean, it
full.
Was almost so much you just couldn't take it in all the time. You know, uh-huh. there was so much going on. You get off and you're walking this whole beach with the elephant seals at the same time this leopard seal is there. They're videoing this leopard seal underwater. And you look around you and the landscape is just, it's indescribable. It's so vast, it's so big, and it's so incredibly beautiful. And there's not a tree in sight. There's no vegetation. But the colors are incredible. Yeah. So, and we were pretty much all on the Antarctic Peninsula mm-hmm. because we were on the ship for 10 days and that's as far as you could go. I mean, you sure. could go farther, but you'd have to spend a lot more time because yeah. it was a long time. And we made a lot of stops. So,
sure.
Which was good.
Did you, I often think of this when I go on a longer vacation and you hop on an airplane, you're done, you hop back, you don't process things. Did you find that you being on a ship, even though it was only a day and a half or 2 days back to Argentina, that gave you more time to really process what you'd experienced?
I think, speaking for myself, it just got started with those 2 days. They told us, those of us who were trying to be photographers, and I do say trying, that we shouldn't really review our pictures for several weeks, if not a couple of months. And in fact, I didn't start taking a look at the 5,000 shots that I took until last week. And that's when I really started, I think, to process the trip, just to remember some of the nuances that hadn't stuck with me when we flew back. So yeah, I think what you're saying is very true. I think you need to take the time to reflect back on where you were to really appreciate what you actually did.
Mm-hmm. We've been speaking with John and Maddie McIndoe, who have come back here just a few weeks ago from an amazing experience, a 40th anniversary trip to Antarctica. It wasn't Fiji. It was Antarctica.
And or Tahiti.
It sounds fabulous. You know, I could talk about this but unfortunately we have another guest coming. But will there be a time when you would consider a public a slide presentation of your trip? Has that entered your minds yet?
Oh, it has entered my mind. Somewhere in those 5,000 slides, there may be one or two that are useful. I think that would be delightful. It would give us a chance to relive it as well.
Sure.
And Buck, I don't mean to interrupt, but if when I jumped up and ran out of the studio about 10 minutes ago, that was our next guest saying they were having some difficulties with the weather and driving.
Oh, so they're not
so
here yet.
They're not here yet.
Oh,
so
we don't have
we
to rush
out. We can chat a little longer
okay.
if you are so inclined.
Well, that's great. Yeah, we were wondering if we were going to have problems with all of our guests tonight getting here. So we're happy that you were able to do it. And also our first guest.
Yeah.
So John's a little behind schedule.
And I should mention, as the just the sidekick here this evening, I was looking up some interesting things on the South Pole while you guys were talking. And on this date, 101 years ago, Robert Scott arrived at the North Pole only to find that Amundsen had gotten there already.
Yeah, like 2 weeks before or something.
A month before.
Mm-hmm. And just what a heartbreak, you know, after such a trek that we can't even imagine as far as how difficult that was. And you didn't have to do quite the same thing.
No, we didn't.
Yes, that goes. Well, back to your experience there. You know, we talked about what was the thing that you didn't expect. Were there things that maybe you expected that didn't happen? Or it just didn't evolve as part of the trip? Or expectations that really weren't there?
I'd have to say I got way more than I expected. Uh-huh. So, and I have to attribute a lot of that to the staff. Uh-huh. They were so ready to be helpful. They were so willing to share their knowledge. They just really wanted people to learn and understand and get the best experience that they possibly could. And if we couldn't land at one spot because of weather conditions or something, they always had plan B, and they really did follow through with that. Just one other thing is, I don't know if anyone saw the March of the Penguins film.
Just gonna bring that up. I'm glad you did.
Well, Greg Marshall is the man who invented or developed the critter cam, which is what was attached to one of those penguins. And, you know, I could sit next to him at dinner at night. He was there,
fabulous?
And he shared all his knowledge, and he's working on some new stuff. But that's the kind of caliber of the people that were on the ship. Mm-hmm. So there was just so much information and so much sharing that went on. It was very cool.
That was a fabulous film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anybody who hasn't seen The March of the Penguins, I'm sure you still can.
Is that the one where the male penguins hold the egg for so long?
Right. And we didn't see any of the emperor penguins because they're the one species of penguin that nests in the Antarctic winter. So they're at sea now. But I shouldn't say that. We did see some emperors, but they were kind of like rocks. They were erratics. But everybody got really excited about seeing an emperor penguin, because they're not normally on land at this time. So anyway, that was pretty fun.
I recall from some of my readings, it was Apsley Girard. I forgot his middle name, but one of the explorers with Scott who went to the one of the coldest places on Earth to try to see the penguins, the emperors there, to find their nests and bring eggs back.
All the eggs didn't come back successfully.
No. In fact, it had to be for him a heartbreak to find out later that they'd all rotted.
Oh. Yeah.
They'd gotten rotten, and all of it, their endeavor was for naught, you know. But I don't recall where I... Oh, The Worst Journey in the World, or The Worst... I forgot the name of the book, so I shouldn't be talking about it, but...
Well, Scott's expedition had a lot more scientific... They did a lot more scientific study than Amundsen did. Amundsen was on a mission.
He was honest about it.
Yeah, he just went for it, and Scott always wanted to learn things along the way, and so
or to get funding.
But they collected Scott's expertise. They collected a lot of rocks. They tried to, you know, they had more into it than just a direct shot to the pole.
I believe they found that he had like 25 or 30 pounds of rock still on the sled. When they couldn't hardly even pull themselves.
Right.
So that's dedication. Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, now, what are you going to do? You've had a wonderful experience for your 40th. Is there a colder place you could find for your 50th?
I don't know.
That's not in the making yet.
I might be sitting in a rocking chair by a fireplace there, by the 50th.
It may change. Oh, I think you two look pretty darn active. I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, I must say that we participated in everything that was offered except for one activity, and that was the polar plunge.
Okay.
There was the opportunity for anyone who wished to don their bathing suits, go out on the platform I had talked about, and jump into the 30-degree water. And we watched from afar, very much enjoying it. And it was interesting, the night before we docked, these people were called forth and given a certificate for their bravery. And then they said to the rest of us, don't worry, you are getting certificates as well. And they read this wonderful piece of text that congratulated us on having the good sense not to do something like that. So, but it, yeah, where do we go from here? I'm not sure. This is sort of it.
There's no sense to look forward yet, I guess, when you've got so much to look back on from this trip.
Well, and I think we're still processing. I know we're still processing.
Sure. One more thing before I let you go. And I know all of our listeners would be interested in hearing this, and we want to know where Lindsay is, what she's doing, when she's going to come back to this neck of the woods and maybe sit in the studio again. And that's Lindsay Mack, for those of you who aren't following the conversation. John and Maddie McIndoe are the proud parents of Lindsay Mack, who is a very successful singer-songwriter. And I believe she is she on the East Coast yet?
She lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and she is working on a album at this time. It's a little bit different than what she's done before, and that's basic. I've heard some of the tracks, and I like them
a lot.
Sounds
great.
But I don't ask her a lot about it because she's sort of quiet about it. So we'll just have to wait and see when it comes out.
And no plans to be here in the near future?
Not specifically, although it's been long enough that it's about time that we can go and drag her over. She misses this place so much that not much more than a year can go by before she'll come back.
We're glad to hear that, because we'd love to have her back.
We'd look forward to that time. And is she? I know she had a little back trouble trying to, you know, playing that instrument in the position she was, created some problems. Has that been alleviated a little, or she just adjusted to it?
Well, her back's doing well, and she seems to have gotten appropriate rehab, although she has it forced her a bit to branch out in the types of instruments she's using. Mm-hmm. She's playing a tenor guitar, for example, at some time, so that she's using a bit more variety in terms of the instrumentation she uses.
We've been speaking with John and Maddie McIndoe and about their trip to Antarctica and their 40th anniversary. We want to thank both of you so much for making the trip up here to be in the studio with us tonight and putting up with all that snow and ice and difficult conditions. And now you can head up to Devil's Track Lake and relax. Thank you so much for joining us.
Isn't it great? I know. Very much.
Glad we got some for you.
We couldn't be more delighted with the weather. This is great.
Good.
Yeah, I got to agree. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.